Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we visit with Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens, and we'll be talking to him about, among other things, using spring bulbs in your garden. We'll also get a sneak preview at this year's holiday display at the gardens, and we'll take your gardening questions as well, so I hope you join in. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Mark Conlock, welcome back. Good to have you with us today.
Good morning, Larry. Great to be here with you.
Let's talk about bulbs just to kick things off here. What should we take into consideration when selecting bulbs for the garden?
Well, wow, there is so much to talk about bulbs. It's one of my favorite topics. I really like adding them to the garden because, you know, you plant them now in the fall and you don't have to do a lot of work with them really. And then you have everything set for springtime. And after our long winters, you have that explosion of color. So, I mean, kind of a strange thing is that like what I like to do actually is in springtime, go around and take pictures of all the areas at Green Bay Botanical Garden where we're like missing bulbs.
Oh.
And then I put them in a folder. And then this time of the year, actually earlier when I'm buying everything, I look at that folder and then I use that to help me determine, you know, what colors of bulbs I want to buy and, you know, which areas we can reuse bulbs into. So, I mean, some of the things to consider, like one big thing might be actually for people is like the critter proof bulbs, because all of the animals and mostly it's mammals like, you know, voles and rabbits and deer. Sometimes they really, really like certain bulbs, like especially tulip bulbs. So if you have to deal and contend with those critters all the time, you're better off probably picking a, you know, resistant one like a daffodil or an allium, an ornamental onion, you know, or a hyacinth, something like that. That's going to be not additional work for you to do. So that's like kind of one big consideration you have to think about. And of course, you think about the colors that you like and the different forms and textures of the bulbs and things like that. And another big thing is like to think about perennializing them and using them amongst perennials and other areas of that your garden that you don't water so much, because one thing the bulbs do like is once they're done blooming and you make sure you leave enough time to like let them, I call it dry down and die down, like 6 to 8 weeks for the foliage to dry down. They don't like to be wet during the summer, like watered all the time. So if you have an annuals around them, you'll actually kind of cause them to rot out throughout the summer. And that's one reason you might not get them to come back every year.
Do you have some favorite places to go to pick out or to buy bulbs or purchase them?
Yeah, when I first started 16 years ago, I bought them from a bunch of different mail order places. And I actually did a little research before coming on, Larry. Like Color Blends is one of the places that's our main supplier because they have, we think, the like biggest bulb for the most reasonable cost. And if you go to their website, which is, you know, colorblends.com, they have like a cool little quick link to see like what's still available because it is a little bit later in the planting season. And then I went to another supply of ours called Brent and Becky's Bulbs. And they say, actually, I guess I would say don't buy from them right now because on their website, they say with all the shipping issues they've had and getting their bulbs to them, they won't be able to ship out till December. So for us in Wisconsin, that'll be pretty late to try to plant them, you know, in the frozen ground. So I did the kind of like localish supplier of Young Seeds. They actually seem to have quite a bit available on their website. So that might be a place for people that are looking to kind of like scooch in under the finish line here to plant some bulbs before the ground freezes to take a look at, as well as like your local garden centers or, you know, even like a big box place. If you're doing some shopping and you happen to see some bags of bulbs and you want to throw a little splash of color in here, you know, those ones, it's like a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. You know, a bulb in the hand might be worth two in the mail order.
You mentioned color a couple of times. What advice do you have when it comes to combining colors?
Yeah, it's such a kind of a personal question, but what I really like to do, and I've been able to help like Color Blends write a couple different things, is like color echoing especially like thinking a little bit broader than just the groundscape, if you will, you know, thinking about your spring blooming shrubs and trees and your perennials and kind of like thinking about your bulbs as being a part of that whole combination. So if there's like, say, you know, a white flowered crab apple you have, maybe you want to underplant with a white flowered daffodil or tulip or something like that to kind of like bring that color down to the ground and make the whole vignette like a larger thing. Or you could go the opposite way though and like contrast it with some other, you know, color like a grape hyacinth or something like that. Or you could do both things, you know, because sometimes remember the bulbs bloom early, mid, late, and then there's like early, mid, late and all that when you look at some of the catalogs. So you could actually have, you know, a bulb display starting early and then trying to think about what corresponds to the time of the bloom of your other plant material. So that's like the tricky part kind of is making sure you match the bloom. So your great idea on paper, you know, actually looks good in real life, because what if it blooms way earlier than your tree does, you know, and then you don't really get the effect you're going for. Yeah. So that's one of the things that I try to do is actually kind of like think about all those things together. So that's where the pictures can help you too, of course.
So larger numbers, what, you know, talk a bit about maybe the method that works best for larger numbers. And then what about smaller groups as well?
Yeah, one of the things we do here at the Botanical Garden is we plan to just finish planting 45,000 bulbs for our spring display. And we probably have like 300,000 in the ground. So we actually, because, you know, we buy it based off of a square footage, which a person might do in an annual bed in their yard. You know, we actually measure them out with like a bamboo stick, 8 inches on center, and kind of like triangulate them in there. So that's how we make sure that the amount we buy fits the space. But for your average person, you know, what you can do is just kind of like scatter them on the ground or space them with a tape measure or something. And then, you know, plant them individually with a soil knife or a trowel or whatever. But another method that you can do for like smaller clumps, or if you want like a more informal planting, is kind of, you know, sprinkle them on the ground or just dig, you know, a hole and kind of like throw them in there like diced, and then, you know, just cover that hole back up and you'll have like a more like a grouping or a bouquet, we call it, of them. So that's a different way to do it. And the other thing is, you know, typically you think about planting the bulbs with the root plate down and the roots down, which is the way we typically do it. But we did learn from Brent Heath of Brent and Becky's Bulbs and did an experiment ourselves where we planted them like, you know, upside down to this side, to the other side. And they all came up and bloomed, you know, so it doesn't really matter. And, you know, another random thing, Larry, that we did that worked actually was like Brent Heath said, he just would donate daffodils to people in Connecticut and plant them with a front end loader where he just like dumped them on the ground and raked them out and then covered them with 8 inches of wood chips. And we tried it and it actually worked. We like planted some in the ground. We put some, just like laid them on the ground and covered them with 8 inches of compost. And then we also put 8 inches of wood chips on top of a group and they all actually came up and bloomed. So like that could be a low tech method for a person to try out, you know, just like throw them on the ground and cover them with some soil.
Oh man, I love it. What about fertilizer? Someone wondered, you know, do you fertilize when you put the bulbs in, or, you know, throw some fertilizer in first, or?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's kind of a garden myth to do the fertilizing with them. At least that's, yeah, I learned a lot of what I learned from Brent Heath. I've heard him talk a couple of times and he's, you know, an expert on it all and other people, but pretty much you don't want to fertilize. You don't need to fertilize when you plant the bulbs. And one kind of a cool thing you can do with, you know, yourself or kids or something is like dissect a bulb. And when you cut it in half, you're going to see that it has like a miniature flower in there and a miniature leaves. And it pretty much has everything it needs to grow and flower that first season. So you don't need any additional fertilizer. Now, what you could do over time is when your bulbs kind of like, you know, grow together and they multiply, is you could put down a fertilizer after they're done flowering and they're like translocating the nutrients back down to the bulb storage structure to make the new bulbs and the daughter bulbs the next year. So I call that drying and dying down, like I think I might have mentioned already. So once the, you know, that part of it happens is when you could fertilize if you think you need to. And one way you know that sometimes is if you have a bunch of them together and you have leaves but not flowers. You know, that means there's enough energy to make the leaves in the daughter bulb, but not enough energy to produce the flower. That's also the time, like if you're so ambitious, you can divide them and kind of space them out so they get enough nutrients from the soil surrounding them, you know, to flower the next years.
Is it hard to do that dividing business?
I would say yes. I mean, we haven't done a bunch of it. And the reason why is because I heard Brett talk, and what he suggested doing was fertilizing them. Like he said to use a, you know, 10-10-10. Our soils are high in phosphorus and potassium, so it'd be ideal if we just had like a 10-0-0 type of fertilizer. But we've done that in our King Shade Garden here at Green Bay Botanical Garden because we noticed that the, you know, we planted 10,000 daffodils and now there's even more in there. And they, some groups of them weren't blooming. So we did do that fertilization method a couple of years ago, and it did seem to improve the flower power without having to go through that hardcore work of dividing all those 10,000 plus bulbs, which would be, I don't know, and probably be impractical for us.
Well, let's take some calls. You can join in, by the way, the number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org as we talk about, well, we've been talking about bulbs mostly, but we can talk about other things as well. But Becky and Ryo, we'll give you a chance. Becky, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Hey, I have a question for your guest, just to follow up on your comment of planting some of those bulbs on the surface of the ground and just covering them with 8 inches of mulch or wood chips. Did you leave them for multiple years then? And what I'm wondering is, do they draw themselves down into the ground eventually? Or do you have any thoughts on how they'll do after 1 year?
That's a good question. Thanks, Becky.
Yeah, Becky, that is a good question. We didn't, in that experiment, we did it just for one winter. But I know that tulips do have like a foot, they call it, where they kind of like reorient themselves in the soil to the proper depth, you know, for them to flower every year and all that stuff. So I don't know. I probably wouldn't recommend like, you know, just like putting them on the ground and putting 8 inches of wood chips and leaving them for multiple years. But it could be an experiment, you know, to try, of course, because you'll at least get 1 year of goodness out of them. And then everything else would be kind of like a bonus. So that's a really good question. And it's a interesting thing to contemplate.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Becky. Appreciate it. Maybe you could mention the bulb designs that you have on the Color Blend website. They're fantastic.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. I was lucky enough to work with Color Blends on that. And there's some other designers that have some interesting ideas on there, too. So if you want to check out that Color Blends, I think the link is on the Garden Talk website. Yeah. I noticed that. So that was kind of cool. One of the other ones that's in there that I was could talk about is I kind of really like the idea of where you use like the miscellaneous bulbs in your turf areas. You know, so that's kind of a different way for people to get bulbs. And a lot of times you use the smaller ones that bloom earlier in there. So it gives you that shot of color right away. And then you do have to remember to let them like kind of go downhill and re-come back. Or we even let them like seed out in there so that they will spread over time. And I've seen some yards, you've probably seen them with the Scylla in there where it's like completely like a Smurf lawn.
Yeah.
There's one in West Dallas that's like completely blue. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty neat to see. And we have a bunch of no-mow grass areas. So that's another area that, to think about using them because you don't mow that area anyway.
Why not? And it can really look nice. Mark Heinlach, our guest today. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas at WPR.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. And you're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Great to have him with us today. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Jenna in Hudson next. Hi, Jenna.
Hi. My husband has planted bulbs a number of times, and we're assuming it's squirrels, but some animal seems to get them. We were just wondering if you had any recommendations.
Yeah, yes. Digging up those bulbs.
Yeah, we do. I mean, I have a couple ideas of, and I can share what we do at the botanical garden, especially with tulip bulbs. What we do is after we plant them, you want to water your bulbs, of course, and especially this time of the year when there's not much left of the growing season so that they start to put down roots. But for animal deterrence, we do like sprinkle malorganite on the ground after we plant them as a way to kind of, you know, get a different odor out there and deter the animals. And then we also spray the ground with liquid fence, which is kind of like a putrid egg garlic mixture, so it doesn't smell very good. I always think it smells like a wet dog ear. I don't know why I think that, but that's my interpretation of it. And we spray the ground after we plant the tulips with that, and we do spray the ground weekly until the ground freezes. And then in the springtime, once the bulbs start growing, especially the tulips, we spray them with that liquid fence once a week until they're done blooming to keep deer and rabbits from eating them. So some of those ideas might be something that you could use, you know, to deter the animals. I've also heard that, you know, like any remaining tunics on the soil surface, which is the covering, the kind of the papery covering of the bulb, you know, squirrels and things kind of look for those. So, you know, you could try to remove those, especially if you don't have a huge amount of bulbs, you know, to just let critters know that there's nothing to look for around there. So those scent deterrents are what we mostly use.
There you go, Jenny. Give that a try. And let's go to Katie in Sturgeon Bay next. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Hi. I have one of those other questions.
Okay.
I have some hydrangeas. They are the globe bloom type bush. They're older. I would say at least 25 years old. And I've noticed for the last couple years, they will only bloom down around the bottom of the bush. They get very large, but the blooms are only at the bottom. What do I need to do?
Hmm.
Did you say they were like a cone flower, like a hydrangea paniculata?
No, they have a big round bloom.
Big round white okay. bloom?
Pink. They're pink. White and pink.
Okay, do you think they're like a type of hydrangea arborescens? Like an Annabelle hydrangea or something similar to that?
I don't know.
They sound like Annabelle's.
They were at the house when we bought it. So I'm not sure what type they are, but the blooms are very large. They're like 10 inches round.
Okay. Yeah. It sounds like an Annabelle or hydrangea arborescens. There's some really good information. Like if you look hydrangea, because they have like different types of pruning methodologies that can sometimes affect the way they flower. But with the Annabelle hydrangeas, they're pretty bulletproof in terms of what you can do to, you know, prune them. So what I would do is, I don't know how you've taken care of them in the past, but you can prune those literally to the ground with like a hedge trimmer this time of the year or early in the spring to kind of like rejuvenate them. Or if you want them to be taller, you know, you can cut them higher up to live growth in the springtime. Now why they're, you know, blooming lower, the only thing I could think of is like, and it shouldn't affect the Annabelle hydrangea. That's why I was kind of questioning it, is like, you know, cold, like if there's a snow line that they bloom below because the buds are protected by the snow. But Annabelle, you know, that shouldn't affect them because they bloom on new wood. So a hydrangea macrophylla, older cultivars, typically bloom on old wood. So if you have something like that and it was, say, protected by the snow line, those buds lower might bloom, but not the top because it got, you know, like too cold that it injured them. So there's a couple different things with the hydrangeas, and it really depends on the type that you have. But the other thing you could do is if it is like an Annabelle type hydrangea, similar to the bulbs like we talked about, like those Annabelles can spread pretty vigorously, and maybe you need to do a little bit of just like extra fertilization through there to give them a little more energy because of how, like, you know, they've all tied together over time, similar to like the bulbs when they reproduce. Does any of that sound like it's applicable to your situation?
You know, since I didn't know what type they were when we moved in, I left them alone the first year, actually for quite a while, and they were blooming. The whole bush was blooming. And then I cut them down to the ground. And after I did that, they would come up and they would get real big and the leaves were beautiful and they started putting on fewer blooms. So then after that, I left them. I just left them. And then in the springtime, then I would pick out the dead parts. Mm-hmm. And they just haven't seemed to do well for some, maybe yeah. 5 years now.
Interesting. 5 years. You have any trees or anything that have grown at all or other kinds of environmental things that might have had an impact, Katie?
No. Okay. They're on the north side of our house, and they love it there. They'll get early morning sun from the east.
Yeah. You probably need to get those identified for sure to see what you've got. And you could probably do that online, right, Mark?
Yeah, definitely. You could probably, you know, just search the different types of hydrangea. If you do have the panicle hydrangeas, the Royal Horticulture Society in like Great Britain, the UK, has a really good information on the different ways you can prune them, you know, to get flowers, different size flowers and flowers at different times of the year. But looking at hydrangea arborescens versus paniculata versus macrophylla would definitely be a good first step to help you get some better information on what they have and how to make them flower better. And for all plants in general, the more sunlight, the more energy they get, the more prolifically they flower. So as Larry was alluding to, over time, if conditions change, you know, that can affect things down the road. If your tree, say, grew bigger and got it has less shade, but that doesn't sound like your particular situation. The other idea would, you know, be to reach out to your local extension agent that might be able to, you know, come over and take a look at it with you too, or send them a picture of it, and they'll be able to help you identify it and give you some further guidance.
Yeah, that's a good tip as well. And, you know, it could be fertilizer too. That's another thing that, you know, been there a long time. And if the area hasn't been fertilized for 20 years, there could well be a situation where you need to put some fertilizer in. Katie, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Josie in Iron Mountain, Michigan next. Hi, Josie.
Hi. I have a question about an invasive weed, snow in the mountain, or bishop's weed, cowweed. I've been fighting it, and I've dug it up and picked out all the white and yellowish roots that I can. And I was wondering if I can plant daffodil bulbs there in the last couple weeks before, you know, deep freeze up here, or is it a losing battle?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you've done a pretty diligent job of trying to get rid of what is there. And the daffodil bulbs, you know, like you're pretty far north, but if you want to try some, I would. I mean, I pretty much always encourage people to try the bulbs no matter what, darn near. You know, if you have other pieces of that invasive species that, you know, are still there, and if it propagates itself from those different pieces, it still may come back. And then you would have to weed around the daffodil foliage or wait for it to dry down, you know, and go underground and just be a storage organ where you could then dig better. Or, you know, if it comes to it, use herbicide above ground, which, you know, is possible with the daffodils because they'll be the bulb will be underground, you know, so you still will have other control options for that invasive weed if you didn't get every last piece of it. So
yeah,
it sounds like you've cleared that area and want to use it.
Yeah, I'd say go ahead and give it a shot. Why not? But you're right, Mark. Josie, you'll have to keep an eye on those weeds, and there are going to be some that are going to come back up, and you're just going to have to keep after them. That's all there is to it. Thank you, though, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Catherine in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I was listening to you last week or maybe a week later, previous, and there was someone on speaking to a product that you could put on weeds and stumps to stop them from re-rooting.
So, and Mark, I'll turn to you first on this. If you've got a stump that you want to, you know, if you can't grind it out, what do you do?
Well, you probably remember the name of the product, but I know there is like something that you can buy that's like supposed to stop the suckers and things from, you know, coming that you can get at your local garden center. The other thing that we do when we say remove an invasive species where we don't, you know, where we just like cut the stump is we will paint like the outside growing surface, the cambium of that stump with a glyphosate, you know, product. Typically what we use is something called Kilzol, and we dilute it 1-to-1 with water. So it's actually like maybe a 25% glyphosate solution. And that keeps the plant from coming back, the stump from re-sprouting. But there's other products for a homeowner that might be more applicable to your situation that if you go to, you know, your local store like Stein's or something, they would be able to help you with. Or Larry might have the product name from the other previous weeks.
Yeah, there are several names, but glyphosate is typically the product that's you're probably going to see on the label. If it's stump killer, there are all kinds of them. Out there, and I think that's what our guest was talking about a couple of weeks back. So I would just give that a try, Catherine, and see what happens. This time, there's going to be a warm weekend, pretty warm weekend, and wouldn't be a bad time to do that. But you need to have the stump, if nothing else, kind of recut so that it's a fresh wound. On the stump before you would apply that material. But I would, you know, you're going to get up to 60 degrees tomorrow in Madison. Milwaukee's probably going to be in that area too, and that's, or 50 at least, and that'll be warm enough to apply that and still have it be effective.
Oh, go ahead, Larry. I was just going to mention one thing, like to kind of piggyback on what Larry said. It's a good time to say do those controls of like invasive things like that if it's warm enough, because this is when like those plants are translocating their nutrients down into the root system. So that's when it's taking that herbicide like down to kill that below ground part that you're trying to get rid of.
Yeah. And this weekend would be a really good weekend to do it over a good share of southern Wisconsin, at least, because the temperatures are going to be right for it. So good luck. Catherine, thank you so much for calling. Esty in Madison, your turn. Hi.
Hi, thank you. So I wonder, as I clean up my garden, whether I should leave the roots of legumes in the ground, since they capture, I can't think of the name of the
nitrogen,
gas.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you. And support fertility in the ground. So should I leave them in, or is it all done by now?
Well, that's a really good question. I really would have to go back in my memory banks to my River Falls knowledge. But I would say, I mean, Larry can tell you what he thinks, but I would say, why not leave them in there? I mean, it'll break down over time more. And, you know, roots in general, you could leave in the ground to break down of almost any kind of plant. It's just that we're typically used to pulling out the whole thing like that. But, you know, I think it would be not a bad idea to leave it in, actually. So
I'd leave it in. Yeah, I'd leave it in too. Good luck, Esty. Thank you for calling. Chris in Shorewood. On to you now. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Larry. I live in Shorewood, a wonderful community, and every year in the fall and the spring, they send a volunteer crew to help us old people clean our yards. Well, my backyard in my garden area was very hard because a river used to run through there and across the road into the Downer Woods. No longer. But my garden is so full of clay. I've put sand on it years and years ago, But a couple of years ago, one of the fathers said, oh, you need some compost. I'll bring you some. Well, he did. He brought bags of something, dumped them in, and I said, let me pay you. He said, no. Well, last year, my garden was full of tall weeds, funny-looking ones. I pulled them out. They came right up again. I pulled them out again. The crew came. They took all of it out. This year, the spring, they came. They did the same thing. And again, these weeds are coming through. What was it in that compost? What can I do? My garden is completely ruined. And this father was trying to be helpful, but it wasn't.
Oh.
Yikes. Yeah, that's a really sad thing. I mean, that's, I guess, an important thing about when you're using compost, to make sure that it's, like, you know, from a reputable place, and that it gets to be high enough temperatures in the compost process to kill those weed seeds. And sometimes, you know, with like our backyard composting or different, you know, places, it doesn't get to that stage. I had a very similar thing happen to me actually when I started at the garden. Like, we compost a lot of our material and do a pretty decent job. We had some volunteers that really were into it. But I don't think we got it quite enough to kill everything. So, you know, when we did spread it, we would have some weed seeds coming throughout there. So for your case, I mean, I would say, you know, the problem is those weed seeds can last for a long time, and they can just, like, keep, you know, going for 15 plus years or more. So you'll probably always have weed seeds coming up in there. One idea I had listening to you was, you know, the idea of, say, mulching heavily so that you exclude light to the soil surface and therefore wouldn't have as much weed seed germination. You could probably also look at some of those ideas of, like, putting, like, a, depending on, you know, it sounds like you're in a wood, so you might not get enough sunlight, to do like some type of a solar thing where you put a black plastic that would get really hot to try to kill some of the weed seeds, you know, in the soil, more than just exclude light so that you could get rid of more of them. Another idea would be planting something good that you like that could outcompete the weed seeds and eventually grow enough to shade the soil surface, you know, and then not have to deal with the weeds because they won't be germinating, because your good stuff would be overtaking it and shading off and be like a kind of a green living mulch of the plants that you want to see.
That's another good idea. And if there are a lot of trees, there'd be a lot of leaves, and the leaves could be, kind of like to run the mower over them and mulch them up a little bit, and you could use, or have somebody do that for you, Chris, and then use that as a mulch to kind of keep those weeds from going up, and then you could plant right into the mulch in the spring too. Plant some things into the right into the mulch and get them going, and not have the weeds have light to get through to sprout. So those are a few ideas. Thank you so much, and good luck, Chris. I hope this works for you. Appreciate it very much, your call. Well, you can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Gail emailed that she heard that the bulbs available these days won't rebloom year after year because they've been hybridized. Is that true, or is it false?
Well, some bulbs, especially tulip bulbs, I think is the one that she might be alluding to. You know, certain ones bloom better over the different years, like Darwin hybrids, these Gregorii ones, and species tulips tend to rebloom more likely than the other ones. But even the other ones, we found, Larry, what we do with ours, it actually is like in front of our annual display areas, we'll plant the bulbs in the fall, we'll enjoy them in the springtime, and then we actually dig them up out of the ground. And then we dry them back in our benches, kind of like in our non-public area above ground until the leaves go down. Then we put them in our well house, which is like 50 to 60 degrees, to initiate a flower bud within them so that we can plant them the next fall. And then we replant them amongst our perennials. And even like the ones that, you know, they say are hybridized that aren't supposed to come back, have come back for probably, you know, 3 or more years and added to and amplified our spring blooming display. So I would say in general, I wouldn't be afraid to use those multiple years and probably get, you know, multiple years of enjoyment out of them, no matter what they are.
Good points. Dennis in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. On the subject of smothering weeds, when people talk about lasagna gardening with covering up soil with cardboard, I thought, well, what about pizza boxes that people usually don't want to use? Recyclers usually don't want to have pizza boxes because of food residue, but I thought, well, maybe they could be used for lasagna gardening.
No reason why you couldn't use pizza boxes. I mean, the cardboard ones. Because they're going to disintegrate over time. And if you put the cardboard down and you cover them with a little mulch so they don't blow all over the place, I think you're going to be fine, right, Mark?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Like the lasagna gardening or putting something like that's a good idea. And also it's in the Italian food group, just like lasagna.
That's a good one. I like that. Dennis, thanks for calling. You go right ahead and use those pizza boxes for sure. Oh, man. Our guest today, Mark Conlock, is director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Great talking with him. We've talked about bulbs and a whole bunch of other things, too. And you can join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller with Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at Green Bay Botanical Garden. Great to have him back. Certainly, if you have a question for him, join in. 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Bonnie in Rice Lake emailed that she has cleaned up her garden, cut down, weeded, all that, and she has all she has left to do is mulch. She's heard that mulching before the ground is frozen is not good. She wonders why. Because some areas have mulch already from last year. If that mulch isn't an issue, why should new mulch be an issue then? And there's a couple things probably to think about. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a really good, that's a pretty interesting question. I've read the same thing that Bonnie has, is like a lot of times, at least like we do this with our roses too, is we wait for the ground to freeze and then we mulch it because we want to keep the cold in actually and like moderate the temperature to keep it cold so it doesn't freeze and thaw and freeze and thaw. So that's one reason to wait until the ground freezes and then mulch, is that, you know, keep, you know, the temperature that you're mulching it at, in essence, especially say you have a new planting of perennials or something that hasn't had time to root into the ground, you know, you want to minimize the freeze thaw process. Maybe other areas of your garden that you have mulch in, you know, it's kind of, you know, broken down over time and things, so it might not be doing quite as good of a job of, you know, moderating the soil temperature as you think. I don't know, what were you thinking, Larry?
Well, the other thing, the reason is that if you mulch around, say, plantings or young saplings or trees or bushes, it provides a perfect hiding place for moles and voles, which they will find that nice little warm spot. And then when winter comes, they'll have a ready supply of bark right next to where they are. So that's why a lot of times people find in the spring that some of their plantings have been girdled. And so to me, that's and I had a friend who had a planting along her long driveway, and every one of those, and she mulched, and every one of those plants was dead in the spring because the whatever it was living in the mulch girdled every one of the plants. So that's another good reason, I think.
Yeah, definitely. That's a really good reason.
So there you go, Bonnie. That's our 2 cents worth on it. Christopher in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Christopher.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Yes, I have a question on growing saffron in Wisconsin. I planted some last August and got a crop last October, and then I mulched it and it made it through winter. I lost about half the bulbs to voles or mice as I mulched, like as you said, a bit too thick, and so they ate a lot of those up. But the plants that did make it through grew in the spring, and then they go dormant for the summer. So I planted one group sunflowers over and one group pole beans, and I pulled them out this fall when, you know, when they were done, and they came back, but only about 10% of them bloomed. And I'm just curious if there's something I did wrong. Should I have not had a cover crop over them, or just curious?
Well, that's really interesting, because actually I was kind of thinking about buying some of the saffron crocus for a little display at our herb garden, you know, since it's like edible. The only things I can think of are, like we mentioned kind of earlier in the program, a lot of those bulbs like it to be dry during the summer months and the times when they're dormant. So depending on what your cover crop was and if it was watered or if it held more moisture, that could have led to death of some of the bulbs, you know, from rotting out, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, that's go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the University of New Hampshire, I believe, has a test of various ways of growing them up in, I think it's zone 4. And some of them they grow in canisters or containers, and so some of those I did as well. Took them in the garage for the winter and brought them out for the summer, and again they grew, but those as well did not bloom. They just have greenery.
Yeah.
And so those were out on the deck, you know, under an overhang, so they didn't get a lot of moisture. I didn't water them this summer, so it's just curious what, you know, maybe I should call the guys in New Hampshire and see, okay, how they do it. But I just wondered if you had an experience, and just curious that they do grow in Wisconsin, so
Yeah.
Yeah. The other quick thing I was going to say, depending on if, you know, you think animals are damaging them, that I was reading in Melinda Meyer's book, was like putting hardware cloth after you plant them to keep them from being like dug up. So on a high value crop like that, maybe that would be an option for critter control. If that's the issue, you find out that is a problem.
Very good. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we had a listener call, and Jill Nadeau chimed in, too, because she's the pizza gal, too. She loves her pizza, and she says, and they both say, animals will have a field day with those pizza boxes. Well, I say to that, make sure you clean the cheese and whatever else off the bottom, inside of those boxes, and then turn the inside down, and that should help, I would think.
Yeah, and maybe use it as a layer in your lasagna, your pizza lasagna garden combo.
There you go. Oh, boy. Let's go to Mary in Green Bay. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a new buddleia that I just planted, and it's a small variety. I planted in late September. It's just getting new shoots, and it's really starting to look great. Do I water it and do that before it freezes, or I just leave it alone? It seems to be doing just fine. So that's my question. Do I water it? And also, do I mulch or leave it till spring?
Those are both really good questions. It's been pretty dry in Green Bay, so, you know, depending on if you think it's established and doing well, you know, you could consider giving it one final drink, you know, here at the end of the year. We did that for some of our newly planted trees and shrubs at the botanical garden before we shut off our water. But definitely I would recommend the mulching, like we talked about with the other question, you know, wait till the ground, you know, freezes, but not too late with the buddleia, because they are kind of like a zone 5 plant and we're on the borderline of the zone 4-5. So what we've done, especially the first couple of years we've planted buddleia, is mulched up at least a foot to help get it through the first winter of establishment. And even some of them, we've mulched them if we have time and remember to do it, you know, in future years, because of them being kind of like on the edge of hardiness by us. And we've had some now getting established, you know, pretty well. But the first year, I would for sure give it some mulch to help it through our winter.
All right. There you go. Thank you so much for that question. Appreciate it. On to Mark in Ladysmith. Hi, Mark.
Hi. See, I've got Carolina raspberries that I've got, and I'm going to cut them back down to the ground. I heard they like acidic soil. Can I put pine needles on to turn around and help that acidic soil, or is that a no-no with those raspberries?
Well, I'll let Larry chime in too, but I think, I mean, you could try that. What I've read is that a lot of times when you try to do, like, say, a topical treatment, it's not enough surface area contact to actually make a change in the pH of the soil so that, you know, it seems like a good idea, but it actually doesn't do anything. Maybe it makes you feel better though and think you're doing something. You could try, like, you know, a powdered sulfur treatment or something like that. But a lot of times our soils have pretty high pHs and the buffering capacity is really high, so that you need to add so much of that material. So oftentimes when we're talking about changing the pH of a soil, you're better off in like a container environment and then sinking that container. But, you know, with those raspberries, I don't, I'm guessing you have pretty, you know, enough of a great pH to make them work, because, you know, we've grown those in other people. It's a pretty common one to have and be successful with. The other thing you would probably want to do is get a test of your soil pH to see what it is in the first place, to see what you're really, you know, what you would really need to do to change it in any fashion. So I'm guessing you can probably won't have to do anything, honestly, to get a good crop of them, unless you've noticed something, you know, in the past being a problem and that's led you to the pH.
Yeah. Now is a really good time to get a soil test too, because they're not as busy. This oil and plant analysis laboratory, UW1, tell them what you're interested in, and they can help you out there. And as far as the pine needles or pine straw, as it's called, it's a good mulch anyway. Don't be afraid to use it as a mulch. It may not. I'm sure Mark's right on the effect that it might have. It would take years and years and years probably for that to have an impact when it comes to soil acidity. But it's certainly a good mulch, and if you've got it, you go ahead and use it. Maybe put it. You might want to put some sulfur down, but you certainly throw the pine straw in there as a mulch. Yeah. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. And Russ in Stoughton. Hi, Russ.
Hi. Good morning. I think you and your host and other previous hosts overthink this mulch thing. You know, I go for the last, I don't know how many years, in the fall, and I get the neighbor's leaves that are raked to the curb, and I chop them up with my bagger lawnmower. And I go by there with a large black garbage bag. And then I throw it eventually probably 2, 3, maybe even 4 layers, inches in a good year. And then I rototill the garden after they're on there. And my soil after 6, 7 years I've lived here is almost like loam. And I grow everything from, you know, green peppers, tomatoes, carrots, green onions, lettuce, cauliflower, and the ground is just fine.
Well, I wouldn't have any argument with you on that at all. I've done the same thing, Russ. And I bet, Mark, you've used leaves as well quite a bit.
Yeah, we used to get some from the city of Green Bay, actually, but they weren't like shredded like Russ is doing, which is a good way to do it, you know, to kind of shred them up. And especially in a vegetable garden situation like you're talking about, it's applicable. It might be a little harder to do it, you know, say amongst perennials and things. You would have to shred them and then, you know, spread them all throughout there, which you could do, of course.
Yeah, and no problem at all. I guess the only thing would be, you know, black walnut leaves would be not the kind of leaf that I would want to be putting in my vegetable area, especially if you're growing tomatoes or other, or peppers. You mentioned peppers, Russ, but I think it's a great idea to use those leaves for sure. And I certainly encourage it. Well, Rick wonders if he can transplant small volunteer trees less than an inch in diameter now. Is it getting a little late for that? Should he leave them in?
Oh, well, good question. I mean, we're kind of on the border of that time period. I would probably lean toward, you know, just like waiting till next spring to do it personally, you know, just because then you'll have the whole spring and summer for them to get reestablished. Whereas right now they're not going to, you know, be able to grow too much. And then you'll have the issues of, you know, heaving around and things. But if they're just volunteers, you could try to do half of them now and half of them in spring if you wanted to like hedge your bets.
Mark Conlack, our guest today. Mark Conlack is the director of the horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. And I wanted to say that it's time to say goodbye and good luck to our beloved producer, Natalie Guyette. She's scheduled many great guests for our show on topics that have inspired us and you as listeners. So, Natalie, good luck to you. We hope you will love your new adventures, and we will miss you for sure. Thanks, Natalie. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Conlack, who is director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And we've been answering your gardening questions, of course, talking about the garden. We haven't really talked about it much, but we will get to that for sure. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions. You can reach us at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And, Mark, let's take another call. Jill in Racine will give you a chance. Hi, Jill.
Hi. You just said garden. I have a question about my new bushes and trees.
Okay.
I have a Hicksewa bird's nest spruce, something called a blue angel white pine, and then what I lovingly call my poodle pine because it has these little tufts that look like a poodle. I usually wrap old pine boughs in them to protect them. Do I need to protect a pretty tall, it's a variety of, I can't remember the name of the pointed evergreen. I wish I could remember it.
Yeah.
Arborvitae. There you go. Should I protect that too?
And these are new, relatively new.
Newly planted here. We've lived here 2 years, and I've been planting things.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, that's... What are you protecting them from?
Cold.
Cold?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I would think a couple things. You know, first of all, if you know that your plant is hardy, you know, you really shouldn't have to cover it unless there's a specific situation where it's, say, getting salt spray or deer damage or something like that. Or, I mean, you could cover it your first year, you know, with a burlap or something like that if you're concerned of desiccation. One thing I would say of a newly planted conifer, I would make sure to, like, water it now while you still can so that it goes into the winter months, you know, well hydrated and can – because the conifers will still be, like, evapotranspirating, you know, throughout the time of the winter time when there's still sun out there and they can't take up moisture through the roots because the ground is frozen. So make sure to give them a good drink here before we go into the winter. And then once the ground freezes, mulch it well if it's not already mulched per our conversations. We typically just cover things with burlap to protect them from deer, you know, so that they don't eat them. And it sounds like a lot of your plants, except for that arborvitae, are pretty resistant to that. So I don't know if Larry has ideas. There's other things you can, like, spray on different plants as, like, an anti-desiccant that we don't really do much of either. So in essence, we typically just let it survive or not. And it sounds like a lot of the plants you have are hardy, so they shouldn't have an issue with cold.
The biggest thing on newly planted, I think, especially the what you have, Jill, is what Mark was talking about, which is watering. And you might they need water, and you should be watering up until the time the ground freezes on newly planted, so that they've got so they don't desiccate so much over the winter. But I agree with you. I don't know, other than maybe protect from deer in a situation. I don't think, if they're in the proper zone, should be all right. And you wouldn't need to do a lot of protection. So there you go. Thank you so much. Chris and I'm sorry. Chris and Racine. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi. My question is, I have milkweed that grows both on the north and the south end of my house. The milkweed that grows on the south end, eventually come fall, it grows pods that, you know, have the seeds like dandelions and blow all over and reseed. But the milkweed that grows on the north side of my house does not. Why is that?
Is it the same variety?
I would imagine. They just started growing there a couple years ago on both. They okay. look exactly the same. The flowers are the same color.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my guess would be the exposure, because I would assume on the north side it's probably shadier, and therefore it has less energy and doesn't have enough energy to produce, you know, the seed pods. Whereas on the south side, it probably gets really good full sun all summer long and all day long, and it has that extra energy to do that.
Yeah, that makes sense to me as well. I think that's what I think is a shade issue, perhaps, there that you're working on, Chris. Thank you for calling. Lori emailed that her ornamental kale has done amazingly well this year. Is there something she can do to keep the plant or divide it for next year?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, the kale is pretty, like, you know, resistant to a bit of a frost, so she should be able to enjoy it for, you know, a bit of time more still. If you know what exactly it was, you could probably get the same seed, you know, the next year. So I personally don't think it'd be like worth trying to protect it all winter long and that kind of thing. But you definitely would be able to enjoy it for a bit longer into the season, probably because of how warm these temperatures are going to be.
Yeah, I think you may be out of luck there, but you're absolutely right, Mark. If you got that same seed, I'd be planting that same seed again next year. And you're probably going to get the same results for sure. Let's see. Arlene in Burlington, we go to you now. Hi, Arlene.
Hello there. I have a question that's been bothering me. I recently dug up phlox that have gotten mildewy and have purchased mildew-resistant phlox, but I hate to throw the old plants away, and I'm wondering if I plant them in a remote area, are they going to contaminate other plants with their mildew habits?
Interesting question. I've done a similar thing kind of in our garden. The one thing is there's the disease triangle, right? So that's like having the pathogen around is one corner, the conducive environment, which is, you know, usually moisture and not a lot of airflow, and then a susceptible host. So when you pick the plant that's resistant, you help with one corner of that triangle. So discarding those plants and not having a susceptible one around is, you know, in general, a good idea to do, especially when you do fall cleanup even too, to get rid of that kind of thing. So, I mean, depending on if you did it like really far away in a complete different part of your garden, you may be able to, you know, try it, but I guess you should just know that you are like keeping that disease around. I don't know personally, I should know, but I don't know like how far, you know, the powdery mildew would travel across your whole yard. But, you know, since they're small little spores, I would imagine they can travel pretty far. So to be safe, you would want to discard it and not use it. To be economical, if you had a different acre that you could put it on, you could try it and see what happens, I guess. What do you think, Larry?
Yeah, why not? Why not? I agree with you, Mark. There you go, Arlene. Thank you for calling. And we have an open line. Get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or email to ideas@wpr.org. Mark in New Glarus emailed. He has a lime lemon tree. He named it Larry Mueller. he brought it inside for the winter. He's fairly small, about 3 feet tall. has 6 lemons and limes growing on. Is that too much fruit for these fragile months? Every year he barely survives, the plant barely survives until Larry can go outside again, where Larry flourishes. Oh, my goodness. I don't know if you've had much experience with lime trees or lemon trees. I've had really good experience. Frankly, the lime tree, I've had as many as 25 limes on limey inside in the winter, and it's never been a problem, but it's in a south-facing window that gets really good light. It's not shaded out, and I also fertilize. Every time I use a fish emulsion fertilizer, and I fertilize every time I water. They're heavy feeders. If you feed your Mark, you're probably going to get Larry to keep growing and putting out limes and lemons.
As Larry, I was really hoping the limey would come up in this segment of ours, and it did again. That's awesome.
Have you raised any lime trees or lemon trees, Mark?
No, I'm really glad you answered that. We have a lime that we bring in our greenhouse, you know, but it doesn't have as much fruit as it sounds like limey does in this this other one. So, I mean, the only thing I was going to say is that's kind of the purpose of having those trees, right? So enjoy as many as you can get.
Yeah. And they're good limes. Oh, they're really good limes. But I think they are heavy feeders, so you need to fertilize pretty regularly if you're going to expect to have many fruits for sure. Kim in Lake Villa, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Kim.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I tell you what, the artillery spores or shotgun fungus has been on my mind for about 3 years, and I'd love to know a way to eradicate it, but I can't seem to find any answer.
Well, I'm not too familiar with that, unfortunately. It sounds vaguely familiar from my days at the extension, but that's what I would suggest doing. Maybe you've already have, you know, contacted your local extension agent to get some advice on what to do, or perhaps they can recommend, you know, a different company in your area to speak with you about, you know, what to do.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with those. I mean, if they're shooting them out, that means that they're sitting and growing until they have seeds or whatever to shoot out. And so I would, at the least, I'd be mowing them off or getting rid of them before they come to some sort of seed situation. But that's all I can think about. You might want to contact your horticulture agent in the Lake Villa, I forget the county, in that county, and see what they have to say about it, because I don't really know either, to be perfectly honest. Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hi, I love this show, and I just had comments, maybe ideas for two of the things that were up the last few questions.
Good.
The one was about the phlox and getting the powdery mildew.
Yeah.
I simply just went online and looked that up a few years ago when that happened to mine. And it said you need to move them further apart. They need a lot of ventilation. So I did, and I haven't had it since. So that went away.
Yeah, good.
The other thing was we created a I like things around here when they can do double duty and just leave one footprint and do two jabs. So when we were taking down our tomato cages from the garden, our new bushes behind the house, we had new bushes that were right behind our house, and they get the full brunt of northern and western exposure all winter long. I swear it's 8 degrees colder than it is on the south side of the house. And so our new bushes, they all got burned out and died. And so then we got newer bushes, evergreens, and we decided to keep the wind off, not the cold and not the rain, but put up the tomato cages across the front of those bushes and then strung burlap across the tomato cages. So it was like a little fence, but none of the burlap is touching the bushes so that it gets all the elements to build up strength and it doesn't get the brunt of the wind. So we've done that now for the first year, which was last year, and it worked great. And then this year also. And then we also applied that same method when we get new trees, little saplings. We take the round tomato cages and turn them upside down and snip the side so that you can get it around the tree, the little inch-and-a-half wide trunk of the tree, without touching it, and wrap the burlap around the outside of that, again, so that the deer can't eat the bark. And so that seems to work really, really well.
Some pretty darn good advice there, sounds like to me. Anita, what do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I really like the idea of how you're repurposing those tomato cages to help, you know, support the burlap and to act as like a tree guard or something that you can put the burlap around for those younger saplings. So that's a genius idea. Instead of just storing them for the winter, you're using them.
Yeah, absolutely. And phlox, that's something I don't know that we mentioned that, but they need a lot of room and to keep them dry. And the idea of sort of spreading them out further, like Anita did, made a big difference. And that's something else for our earlier caller to consider, too. Thank you so much, Anita. Nancy in Grafton, your turn. Hi.
Should I trim back my bridal wreath? Or if I do that, I suppose I wouldn't get any flowers on it next spring. And the other question or the other story is my daughter went and got some of those burlap bags, old gunny sacks we used to call them, mm-hmm. and she put them in the garden, but she filled them up with, or at least partway, with soil, and they put some seed potatoes in there, just the eyes, you know, the eyes had it. And anyway, so by golly, they were red ones, and did they grow beautifully in that garbage, in that burlap bag. So that was kind of neat. So, and never tried that before, you know, but you can always try something once.
Nancy, thank you.
Yeah, that's a really cool idea. Yeah, the bridal wreath you wouldn't want to prune now because usually spring things that bloom in springtime, you know, have the buds already now for flower buds. So you typically prune a spring bloomer after it flowers in the spring, and things that bloom later in the year you can you know, prune it now, say, but I would say no for that. But I like your idea of the gunny sack, and we have like this small square foot space gardening at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, typically that the master gardeners run, and they've done things kind of like that, but they, instead of like a gunny sack of soil, they had, you know, just like a plastic bag of soil that you would just buy at a garden center, and instead of dumping the soil out, they just cut a hole in it and planted like, you know, a squash in there and threw it on the ground and the thing grew and was fine. So the gunny sack idea is kind of a neat way to do it a little more organically than a plastic bag, I guess.
Oh, it's great. Thank you, Nancy. Appreciate it. You mentioned the garden, and here we haven't talked about your light display. That holiday light display is fantastic. Talk about that, Mark.
Yeah, Larry, that's coming up. We start it the day after Thanksgiving, and it runs through right before Christmas, and then it kind of starts up again. So it's a really cool event. It's been going on for 25 years, and it's a way for people to enjoy the botanical garden in the winter months. One of the unique things about it is it's a holiday light display, but it's all botanically themed. So there's, you know, flowers, insects, a butterfly house, an icicle forest, a big tree. Okay, I was going to use this joke. I would call it one of the most religious display that we have, the praying mantis.
Well, it is gorgeous, and it's open. Obviously, best is most fun to see it at night. But is it every night, or how's it going to run?
Yeah, it runs Thursdays through Sundays, and then the week after Christmas, it's open during that week. So our website, you know, gbbg.org. has all the information and the particulars. There's different price tickets based on peak night versus off nights and a way to get your tickets online. And last year we went to an advanced ticket option with COVID, and that's something we're going to continue through. So make sure you go and get your tickets online, you know, for those advanced tickets. And that's a way for us to limit everybody so that we can do all the safe practices during this COVID era and still get people to enjoy the beautiful Garden of Lights with the over 325,000 light bulbs that we have there. So just a different kind of bulb that we work with at Green Bay Botanical Garden.
And it is a gorgeous, gorgeous display every time. And you've got you're going to be expanding the children's garden area, which I loved what you have now, but what you've got planned looks really like something.
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's the Carol and Bruce Bell Children's Garden. So we're expanding on what we have right now, which is about half an acre. And the whole new garden will be 2.5 acres, including, you know, the Gertrude B. Nielsen Children's Garden portion that exists right now. It's going to be probably our largest construction project. It's a $11.5 million overall capital campaign. And the construction is around the $6.5 to $7 million area. So we're actually going out to bid that project in the next, at the beginning of December, and hopefully construction will occur next spring and summer, and the plantings in fall, and everyone will be able to see the grand opening in 2023. So the whole idea behind it is kind of like connecting people and plants and thinking about our different ecosystems and, you know, how we're all involved in this natural world and what we can all continue to do to kind of grow it and to make it a better place and nurture nature in our own backyards and, you know, take that home to what we do every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I tell you what, go online to the website, the Green Bay Botanical Garden website, and take a look. There's some artist conceptions and so forth that are really, it really looks nice. Brownie in Sun Prairie, what's on your mind?
I'm calling with a follow-up to the call you had regarding the shotgun fungus a little bit ago.
Yeah.
What I found is it's typically related to bark mulch that is put in around trees or around the edges of a house. If that's removed, you can remove it, replace it with a fine stone or something, and that should take care of the problem. It typically will explode onto decks and siding and windows and so on the sides of the home where it's exposed. And cleaning it is very difficult. Bleach is one of the things that can be used, but even that is very difficult. So
get rid of the bark and put some stone down. That is great advice. Thank you so much for that information. Really appreciate it. And Mark, thank you so much. We'll look forward to another visit from you down the road. But I'm hoping I can get up to see that light display again this year. I'll have to get online and get my tickets. Thanks again. Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, our guest. So great to have him with us. Monday, Jesse LeGrew's back to talk about tech-related gift ideas and what to do before you buy them online. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, but stay with us right now. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.